Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Table Topics Podcast. My name is Caleb, and joining me, as always, are
Chris,
S,
Santiago.
And today, I promised it, and you know we always keep up on our promises. We're doing the second edition of Eclipse Phase. So we covered last episode, the first edition. This one, we're going to be doing a bit of a comparison, a contrast, what we like, what we don't like, changes that they made. But you might be thinking, if you haven't listened to the first edition episode, what are we even talking about? We'll give you a brief primer, just so you know what we're talking about if you haven't listened to the previous episode. I highly recommend you do, because you'll get a lot more context about what we're talking about. But Eclipse Phase, without getting too far into it, but similarities are, it's the same setting.
Yeah.
That doesn't really change much. So what is this setting? Brief primer on what that is.
So Eclipse Phase is basically this sci-fi setting where humanity has left Earth and has colonized the rest of the solar system. And it's kind of a survival setting where, you know, it's like the ups and downs of like hyper technology and other like threats from within and outside of our solar system that threaten the survival of humanity. Yeah. It's like very much a survival setting throughout the solar system.
It's a far future, sort of post-apocalyptic-esque future in which it's so far into the future that it kind of gets to that sort of darker, more eerie situation where there's been
the standard setting for Eclipse Phase is one where you play as a member of Firewall, which is an organization that's meant to counter X threats or threats that that are existential to humanity, that would end humanity. And that kind of gives you the premise of the setting as a whole. The grand majority of things that you will encounter in Eclipse Phase that are actual threats are threats that would encompass and threaten all of humanity.
Yeah. So there's just constantly things threatening to erase existence.
Yeah. So, like, that's, I feel like, the core of the setting. Like, there's, like, a whole factional war thing where it's, like, there's the inner systems versus the outer systems. There's a whole exploration of different societal, like, models and different, like, economic models than what we would have in the real world. But it's also, like, super sci-fi with, like, all these, like, nano machines and, like, all this futuristic tech that, like, some parts of it even seem like magic. Specifically, there's, like, psionics that is, like, technically technology, but, like, you look at it and you're like, eh, I don't know.
More, like, psychic abilities that kind of fulfill the same sort of roles in a more classical tabletop role-playing game that magic fills.
Yeah.
It's very fun because it's both post-scarcity in that sci-fi setting, whereas at the same time it's apocalyptic. Usually in the apocalyptic settings, you're going to see a lot of, like, you got to scavenge for food and, like, fight to survive and, like, have other people being your obstacles. Whereas in Eclipse Phase, it's really more about these external threats as opposed to internal fighting within your society.
And fighting is, like, kind of, like, the problem.
Yeah, like
sometimes
factions and whatnot. That's a big part of it, too. But it's one or the other, I think, mostly.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a very interesting setting. If you want more details, I encourage you to go back, listen to our first edition episode. But setting wise, second edition is exactly the same setting as first edition, to the extent that even some of the splash books, some of the extra books for first edition that were all setting related, that didn't like have any mechanic related stuff, are just usable with second edition. They're in fact, like, even the creators are like, just use them because it's all the same stuff.
I think there's like one or two things that changed. Like, I think one of the factions got reworked, but minorly so, and just very minor things that don't really matter for any sort of story. So you can definitely port over the same setting if you're moving from Eclipse Phase first edition to second edition.
Mechanically, there's also a lot of similarities.
Still a D100-based system.
Yeah, so it's still like a system where again, rough overview, you have like a value that you're trying to roll under with a D100 set of dice. The higher you roll, as long as it's still under your like skill value, the better your roll. That is like the summary of the dice mechanics. It's still pretty much the same.
Yeah, you got your skills, your attributes. Mm-hmm. Those give you a target number that you have to roll under with getting as close to it as possible. Mm-hmm. That's the exact same as first edition.
Yeah.
One thing that is different about that, if we want to get into that.
Yeah, let's start talking about
differences. One thing that is different about that specifically is, in terms of the rolling mechanics, degrees of success and margins of success, that's been changed from groupings of 10 to get like a superior success or superior failure or whatever it was called in first edition, I don't quite remember, but now it's just statically set at 33 and 66 as being
the thresholds
for superior successes and failures.
Yeah. So, in first edition, it was how far away from your skill level you got, wasn't it? Something like that? Or was it still how far away from 0 and 99?
It was how far away from the target number with those, I think it was like up to 30.
Yeah.
Defined, like if you were 30 away but you still succeeded, within 30, then it would be a superior success.
Yeah. Something like that.
Don't quote us on that. Yeah. It's been a little bit from
when we went over the first edition mechanics, but this, as well as other mechanics, just it's like the same thing but simplified, I feel.
I mean, I think that's a lot of what the difference between first and second edition is, a lot more streamlining and simplification, which honestly I think this system really benefits from, because it is very in-depth.
It is way less math when you roll the dice.
Yeah.
Because I found a lot more as we were playing second edition, I would roll the dice and I could see the number and instantly know if I had superiors or not.
Yeah.
Just based on my target number. It wasn't, okay, I rolled a 50. Okay, now I need to calculate that back from my target number and do some math, figure it out. Okay, did I have my modifiers correct? And then...
Yeah, let me reference three different things to figure out, is that a success to the margin that I need? Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah, basically, just in case we weren't clear, the way it is now in second edition is there's basically three different ranges, 0 to 33, 33 to 66, and 66 to 99. If your roll is a success, the further away it is from 0, the better. If your roll is a failure, the further away it is from 99, the better. So the closer to 99, the more superior it is. Which ends up like saying, 0 to 33 are normal successes and failures, 33 to 66 are superior successes and failures, and then...
No,
you got it wrong.
It's reverse for failure.
It's reverse for failures,
So 33 to 66 is a superior success. Or, 33 and above is a superior success.
Yeah.
And then 66 and below is a superior failure.
Yeah. So the 33 to 66 middle ground is superior both failure and success.
Yes. 66, that's where the Venn diagram overlaps.
Yeah. 66 to 99 is superior, double superior success. But regular failure.
That's correct.
We're going to post a link to the chart because it explains it way better than us verbally doing.
Definitely.
But that is also a good thing that there is a chart that is very intuitive. Like you look at it and it's like, oh, this makes sense as soon as you look at the chart.
Yeah, reading the rules, it was like, what does this mean? And then we looked at the quick reference guide and it's like, here's a handy little chart. And it's like, you could have just shown me that.
It also kind of makes sense from a logic point standpoint, because the only way that something as low as a 32 as a example of a double failure is a failure is if you have no skill in it. So obviously if you have no skill in it and you try to do it, you're more likely to have a really bad failure in it.
It does have some sort of like harm to it in terms of really skilled characters never have bad failures, really, except for critical failures at like the super high levels. So if I have a 90 in a skill, there is only one thing I can roll that's a really bad failure. And that's... that takes away, in my opinion, some of the like fun of the chance of games like this, where it's like, oh, I always know I'm going to succeed. It's just, am I succeeding more than the other guy? And it still suffers from the same problem that I had with the first edition, where it feels kind of like a coin flip when it's two, like, relatively skilled characters.
Like, equally skilled characters?
Yeah, where it's just like, oh, did I roll higher or not?
Yeah, but that's, like, what the skill thing is. I feel like that is also where situational modifiers help more. I feel that in Eclipse Phase, and like, second edition, first edition, and other similarly crunchy systems, I'm thinking similarly for things like Shadowrun, etc., where it's like it a little bit relies on you being in bad situations to give you situational modifiers to challenge a skilled player, like a character that is skilled in a field.
And I like that. I think it makes sense in terms of RPing as well. It's like, oh yeah, that would cause your character, even if they are skilled, if they're in a very, you know, precarious situation, that it definitely, you won't just fully succeed all the time.
Yeah, it just feels like in something like Shadowrun, a skilled character bricking a roll is more likely than in Eclipse Phase.
I agree.
Yeah. So it's just that balance of, do skilled characters fail often enough that it still feels like a meaningful consequence?
Yeah.
I don't think that Eclipse Phase 2 necessarily hits that mark.
Yeah. I mean, like, I suppose that's not, like... You know, that is a weakness in the system. It's the same thing we had in Eclipse Phase 1. Like, what if you were to compare that aspect to Eclipse Phase 1, is it any better or worse? I'd say it's, like, it's only better because it's easier to see. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, more streamlined. But, like, if you crunch the numbers, like, and you're only concerned about numbers, it's pretty much the same. Which is, like, I mean, like, it's what you want to see in a second edition or a third edition, you know, in an improvement to a system where it's, like, technically, like, in the deep level, it hasn't changed mechanically. All that has happened is that it's easier to play. Yeah. Like, right?
Yeah. I, just to echo that point, I think it is very much a refinement of the system in second edition. Mm-hmm. And it does simplify a lot of things. And I guess that's the main quandary that arises from simplifying from first edition to second edition is, has it lost anything that, you know, made it fun to play? Has it become too simplified?
I don't want to get into that right now.
No,
but
of course.
I do, like, as a short thing, I do think second edition has lost something that, for me, I found very fun from first edition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of the crunch of the dice mechanics, like, just how margin of success and failure works, I don't think it lost any crunch that was fun. It was just extra math and time spent figuring out what the bones of the dice than anything else. And I do love systems where you can roll your dice and everyone knows whether the results of your dice were good or bad as soon as they hit the table. Like, in D&D, very classic, you roll the nat 20, everyone's like, hell yeah. Roll big number, good. Mm-hmm. We're all happy. Mm-hmm. So having that, like, simplified experience really brings that back to Eclipse Phase for me. Whereas first edition, I was very, very frustrated with that. But in this one, I'm like, oh, I rolled a 66. We all know I'm good at this thing I'm doing. We're having a great time.
One way that, just to elaborate on simplifying in terms of rolling and target numbers and stuff like that, one thing to note is I think the amount of skills have been cut in half, which, honestly, there were a lot of skills. There still are.
There were a lot of unnecessary
skills.
They got rid of networking as a skill completely.
Yeah.
Which I think is a good choice.
I like the way they handle it.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, if you look at just names of skills, I don't feel like they did not cut the skills in half. However, a bunch of the skills that they did cut were skills that had, like, a option afterwards.
Yeah.
Namely, like, networking is, like, you get networking blank, and then you have to fill in the blank, and you can have networking multiple times. So on your skill sheet, it fills out quite a few skill slots.
Yeah.
But, like, since they cut out networking as a skill, that cut out all networking blank.
Yeah.
The same thing with knowledge skills. It used to be, like, you had all these different skills that were all different knowledge skills. Now, all knowledge skills are just one skill. Knowledge blank.
Yeah.
Instead of having academics and...
Interests.
And
professional.
Profession.
Or profession.
Yeah, something like that. Now it's just, like, knowledge skill. And that's all knowledge skills. So if you look at a skill and it says knowledge, that's a knowledge skill. So it's not an active skill.
Yeah.
That is things your character knows.
Which I think is a great... I mean, like, ultimately, in a game of Eclipse Phase First Edition, academic, profession, and interests all essentially did the same thing.
Yeah.
It just explained where you were getting that knowledge from, which is a narrative thing that you can just talk to your GM about. You don't need to be like...
Yeah. Also,
it doesn't need to hit the mechanics.
Yeah. Exactly.
Also, it's very obvious. Like, if you have knowledge skill, you know, pediatric doctor, that's very obvious.
No,
that's
a profession. No, you don't understand, sir. I did that on my spare time.
That was a hobby. I'm not licensed. I just know a lot about. I'm just really passionate about it.
It says here you have academics Riz. Yeah, I am professor of quantum Rizics.
Well, I think that actually follows into my next point: is character creation has become streamlined.
So
I really like it. I know that there's some dissenting opinions.
Yeah, so character creation is basically, it was an optional model from one of their side books where it's like, okay, do this life path system. Now it's the main character creation is this life path system.
Yes.
It's like you pick a bunch of like life choices, like, you know, where you come from, how you grew up, what kind of being you are, because in Eclipse Phase you're not necessarily human born. You could be like an AGI, you could be some kind of animal uplift, you know, what have you. And then you pick, like, you know, like a profession or, you know, what kind of work you do. And so it's like you pick, like, I think it's like four or five things.
Yeah.
And then, like, that comes to
bundles rather than individual, let me spend these points. It's less of the point buy system. Which you can still do.
Yeah, you can still do. But the base character creation is now pick these things, they're bundles, and they combine together and they make a character sheet, and then at the end you have a bit of customization you can do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I personally really like it because I was very busy in the week coming up to our one-shot, and the second edition character creation passed a very important test, which is... I called Santi on the phone and was like, okay, I need to do character creation. Can you walk me through it over the phone? And he just tells me, like, hey, here's the types of things we're looking at, and I could just make choices. And at the end of an hour-long phone call, my character was fully done and ready to go, which I couldn't have done for first edition at all.
No.
But that's absolutely something that you could do for something like Lancer or Shadowrun or... Shadowrun 6th edition, not 5th. Or D&D. Like D&D.
Yeah.
Where it's like, if you are the GM of this game, you can walk a character, player through character creation very easily.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, hey, I just need you to pick from a list of these 10 things five times. And then we'll do a little bit of customization.
And you can fine tune afterwards. It's like, there is a minimum amount, but there is also, it can be extended out to the point where you're almost doing the exact same thing in first edition, where you can very much min-max to your heart's content if you really want to do that.
Yeah.
But it allows for less experienced tabletop role players or people that just don't enjoy, you know, the minutia of character creation, just a simpler way to get through it.
It is definitely more accessible, I'll admit that.
To be, like, very specific with the customization, at the end you get a number of points that you can buy additional gear or additional skills or what have you. But then it also says any of the things you have gained from picking one of these packages or picking one of these paths or these decisions, you can swap for an equivalent thing that is different.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, this thing gave you 40 points in InfoSec, and instead you want 30 points in Athletics and 10 points in Deceive. Just swap it around, and it's fine.
Yeah.
The only thing it says is, like, don't reduce your knowledge skills less than this without GM approval, because And this is similar to what you had in first edition. First edition, there was like a minimum amount of points you had to put into knowledge skills. And I think that's just like a character creation balancing thing they do. But basically, at the end of the day, you can min-max. You can be like, I want to take 2 points out from here and 2 points from here, add 4 points to this, yeah. and do the very like Excel sheet min-maxing if you wanted to. But baseline, if you just wanted to make a normal character, you almost didn't have to touch that at all.
Yeah, you can make an absolutely serviceable character in like an hour,
yeah.
which is great.
Mm-hmm.
What do you not like?
Sorry, dude, let's hear it.
God, okay.
He's on the hot takes mic today.
No. It's not really a hot take per se.
I think we performed very good defense, so
yeah,
I'd
yeah.
love to hear what you think.
All right, so,
all right, prosecution, go ahead.
You guys aren't on the stand. I'm on the stand. If anything, the defendant go. No, so... Here's the gist of it. Yes, you can customize it after doing the life path thing, and you can switch stuff around, and you have these points, and it looks very similar to first edition in that like you can do all these things and what have you. Looking at it, looking at how many points you get, looking at the choices that you can make, looking at the kind of customization options that you have with regards to your morph, which is your body, and your ego, which is your like mind or soul, and your gear. Everything has been, and this is part of the cycle of simplification and streamlining, and it's a little sad for me, is a lot of the options have just been erased or whittled down to like nothing, in my view. When I was making my character, a lot of the options and a lot of things that I would have done with a first edition character, I didn't do because I didn't have the option for it. I made a similar character using first edition rules, and I, one, got a lot more stuff for the points I had. I had a lot more freedom in the way that my points were handled, and I got to do a lot of more stuff with... in general, the way that I wanted to express my character.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big things that I felt while making characters was that in second edition, you do have the option of being like an AI, an AGI, or mm-hmm. or an uplift like ape, or uplift crow, or octopus, or
mm-hmm.
just being a human. And in first edition, picking that choice had tangible changes on every other choice you made. Whereas in second edition, in my view, like it was just letting you know that you were that thing.
So I understand where you're coming from, because there were like certain traits that were specific to picking
mm-hmm.
that those ego backgrounds. Right?
Mm-hmm.
There's stuff like AGIs need less points to learn computer-related skills, but more points to learn like certain charisma-related skills. It was something like
there's a trade-off.
Yeah, it is, and that is like a character creation trade-off to picking your ego background. In this, there isn't that kind of character creation trade-off. There is like, if you're not gonna modify your character too much, it's like you get certain skill sets for picking your background, which is like generally to like the general player is equivalent, because they were gonna put points into that anyway. But I understand that if you were trying to make something very specific and very niche, that picking a certain ego background doesn't put the same character creation limitations or boosts to
Let me give you an example of a character that I made in first edition
mm-hmm.
when I first played the system years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I made an AGI character
mm-hmm.
that had in his body a thing called a Ghost Rider module.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ghost Rider module lets you have another ego also be in your body and kind mm-hmm. of like watch stuff and interact digitally, but just watch, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And he also had another module that I can't remember the name of right now that let him basically split his ego inside his head into multiple copies for like an hour. Mm-hmm. And so
at any one time, he had 4 to 5 copies of himself inside his head. Mm-hmm. And each one of those copies could do hacking individually. Mm-hmm. So he was a hacking character that basically got 5 times the amount of hacking actions because he was an AGI that was forking himself.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that in second edition.
You can't do it because... So I was the GM for second edition, and I did look through stuff, but like I didn't look at like details, like what is in the gear and stuff. Is just that gear not available?
That Ghost Rider is. The splitting thing is not it. The way that hacking works is not it. You just can't make that character anymore.
Yeah. I mean, to your point of your ego doesn't give you any mechanical benefits, I strongly dislike that in tabletop role-playing games. It just the idea of your background or your character, like
your birth.
Yeah, the circumstances of your character's birth should not, because it kind of narrows down and homogenizes characters. Mm. If you're like, hey, all AGIs are better at hacking, then it becomes optimal. To if you want to play a hacker character, make them all AGIs. Yeah. So from an optimizer perspective, it kind of pulls flavor out of the system because I don't get to make choices. I'm just like, I am now the thing that is optimal, and every character I make will always follow the optimal thing because that's just what my soul wants to do. But removing those, and then it's just like, okay, this is a flavor thing. It might come up in narrative play, but not necessarily touch your character sheet as a, hey, you're a fucking octopus. That's just how it is, buddy. Yep. Like, I like that so much more than...
There's an objective right and wrong ego to be.
I don't want characters' backgrounds to be optimized. And you see that a lot in new D&D, where it's like variant human was just the best thing. It was objectively the best thing, and any optimizer was like, I'm picking variant human. So they made here's a customized origin that's equivalent to variant human, and you can be whatever you want. Mm. It's like, we're okay with this power level, but like...
Flavor-wise, you can pick another race.
Let's flavor-wise not just be a human all the time, right?
I think, to your point, I think maybe it's fair to say that theory crafting has taken a bit of a hit in second edition. In terms of, like, really trying to, min-max or optimize in whatever way.
But I feel like, this is an interesting, like, difference in opinion. Because, like, Santi is like, we've lost variety in character builds. And Chris's argument is, in exchange, we've gained variety in character
narratives.
Stories and narratives.
Yes.
And it's funny because you guys are the opposite ends of the spectrum because, like, Chris is, like, the more optimizer of the two of you, and Santi, you're more narrative-driven.
Yeah.
But I feel like maybe it's because of that, because Chris is concerned about optimizing builds. You want the freedom in narrative to fit whatever build you want.
He doesn't want a classic pitfall there.
Yeah. And because Santi, like... will make an elaborate narrative, he wants a variety of builds that he can fit into these narratives.
Yeah, he wants a narrative that will also not just be hindered by the idea of what it is.
But for character builds, I don't really see that as a problem with the character creation itself. Maybe, like, the changes to hacking do limit that, but first edition's just been out a lot longer. There are a lot more splash books and options and, like, content that exists there.
Mm.
Do any of your concerns go away if there are, like, splash books to add more options in that you can choose a character creation?
So, yes, technically. It's just, as one example. In first edition, with just the bare book, like the first edition core rule book, you could customize your weapon that you bought with a dozen different types of ammo, a dozen different types of attachments, and kind of like have multiple that do different things. In second edition, you can't do that. You get different ammo types, maybe, but by following the rules as written, you get maybe like a couple rounds of that special ammo ever, and then you have to buy the rest in game. And it's not like a thing that you picked up as a core character. It's like, I am a freelance private security cop in this station, and because of that, I have a contract that lets me have unlimited amount, not unlimited, but like I have like a steady supply of non-lethal rounds. And that's a thing that you can do in first edition. In second edition, it's like, I am that job and I have 20 rounds to my name. And if I run out, I sure hope someone has them.
Yeah, but I feel like there's two like mechanical things that we're not too directly talking about but are affecting this conversation. So the first is the limited customization point. So you have all these things that the in the character creation, you're given all these different bundles.
Yeah.
And then at the end you have these customization points to make changes with, and that's really all you get to pick gear with. Like, you get some gear out of the bundles, but really, like, you're limited to this a small pool to pick gear with. And if you want to do other things with that pool, like, let's say, you know, bump some stats or whatever, that is taking a higher percentage out of your gear slots. So there are, in first edition, there are other things you can cut to get more credits for to buy gear with, and that is a rules as written limitation. But like that one is, for example, I look at it and I'm like, you can work with your GM to go around that because it says you can trade for equivalent things. Like if I was doing a longer game, this was a one shot, so I didn't like really like stress over the character creation too much. But if this was a longer game and you came to me and you're like, man, I want to buy all these weapons, I just don't have the points for it, I'm like, okay, let's cut some of the stuff you got from the bundles and give you the equivalent in credits to buy stuff.
Yeah. So here's the other problem.
Yeah.
Is that items in the game are measured not in credits, but in minor, major, or I can't remember what the third quality is. But like they're how much they cost, but they don't give you a credit value.
But that's in first edition as well.
In first edition, they had that, and they had a credit value. And when you're making a character, you don't say, I get one major and two minors. I say, I have 5,000 credits. I can get a lot of minors, or I could get two major. Like, it's not... It's like the issue with spell slots in D&D, where it's like, I have 4 first level spell slots and 2 first level or second level spell slots, and that's all I get, and I can't convert 4 first level spell slots into 1 second level. It's, I have 4 first level spell slots. In second edition, it's, I have 2 majors and 1 minor. In first edition, it's, I have 5,000 credits I can spend however I want.
Yeah. And one is more overwhelming for the new player.
No, I see, the thing is, I acknowledge that.
But again, even with that, that is something that in a long game, you could just work with your GM to just be like, okay, we're just going to give each of these a credit value, translate it, works.
Okay, but like, all right.
But that's effort for the GM.
That is effort for the GM.
That's moving away from rules as written.
Yeah, but yeah, rules as written, I see that limitation. I'm just talking about like a possible workaround that
I think it's a very minor workaround to introduce something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's so many things that can be like, earned through play and not directly from character creation.
Because
you have a lot of systems, I feel, nowadays where characters come out of character creation already, like, fully equipped, full-fledged heroes.
Eclipse Phase 1 is very much like that, where it's like, you get a lot. It's like, alright, you guys got a lot of shit right out the gate. That's why character creation is pretty overwhelming in first edition, for the new player at least, is you come out fully geared. And there is obviously, you know, some upgrading, but I think it is very much you start at a very high level and then it is grinding your way up to marginal improvements.
Yeah. The second thing that I was going to say, and this is about the gear, is there are some mechanics that they have taken away to declutter the system that a bunch of gear relied on. Especially, like you were talking about it, and that reminded me of it like much earlier about like having multiple turns. In general, the system has decluttered so that it's not doing like multiple turns for any one character per round. That's why they removed the speed mechanic. Speed mechanic is actually a mechanic that I liked as someone who plays a lot of these sci-fi games that want to like have non-standard rounds and turns per round. It was like a very elegant way of doing it, where you have a speed value and that's the number of turns you got in a round, and it's just you went through the entire thing like your
initiative order
for all the characters that have speed one. The minimum speed for any character is one. You can't be reduced to less than one speed. So you'll go through with all the speed one characters, and then you'll be like, does anyone have speed two or higher? Then you'll go through those speed two or higher characters, then three or higher, four or higher, that type of thing. And that is like, in first edition was a very, to me, clean way of doing some characters can have multiple turns per round. And that's that is exactly what those fork modules and stuff were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Is they were giving you one more speed only to use for mental actions. Mm-hmm. I remember like the wording for it was that specifically. And they removed that mechanic. And I think it's part of, they seem to have removed anything that is messing around with turn order. Now turn order feels like much more like a classic D&D type of turn order, where everyone gets one turn and that's it.
It reminds me a lot of moving from Shadowrun 5th edition to 6th edition. Mm-hmm. They did a very similar thing in terms of initiative, where there's, well, I mean, it's not one-to-one, but it is very similar, where you have
multiple turns,
and subtract 10 and then keep going. Whereas 6th edition, it's like you get more actions, but you don't have more turns to go through. So,
So in combat, you have Chris taking 5 turns, and everyone else is like, oh, I got my one.
I did my one a little while ago, so I just keep going.
That's 2 in an hour.
I feel like this actually is a design thing that also kind of, like, is probably the most impactful for encounter design as well. Because, like, in something like Eclipse Phase and other sci-fi systems, if you want an enemy to be threatening, they kind of have to be able to go more often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because otherwise it's like they're outnumbered 4-to-1. And like typically the players have a lot of resources to deal with an enemy. And if they get to go 4-to-1, that's very difficult.
I mean, like in D&D, you have legendary actions and stuff.
Yeah.
That's how they handle it.
That's how they handle it. And so that's kind of a lot of the big boss type enemies, like single big boss type enemies in Eclipse Phase, first edition, used to be like they'll have more speed. And that way they're going multiple times. That way they can be threatening in physical combat. I feel like this kind of change makes physical combat less threatening, but also means when you design encounters, they can't be focused on physical combat. Like not a one-to-one, like, or a boss-type physical combat. It has to be, like, you're outnumbered by this thing, or there's a problem other than the physical threat to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly see that, but at the same time, your bad guy's gonna have different mechanics than the player characters, and they probably should, in order to like make an interesting challenge. Because if the bad guys are always following the exact same rules, then it's much harder for them to properly
get predictable for the PCs as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also, like I agree. I think it's I don't know too much of like the enemy designs. Like mm-hmm. I didn't read the GM specific part, so I don't know how you can design like maybe a big bad, so I won't be able to talk to that. But
I mean, what is everyone's opinions on the removing speed as an attribute, like how many number of turns you get? Because I have not found a system that I like that in.
Yeah, I dislike it
for player characters. Like,
yes.
Boss monsters being able to, like, do multiple things. Like, we see it in Lancer, where, like, certain Lancer bad guys, it's like, and they're super cool, so they get to go after every player turn, and you're like, terrified.
Mm-hmm.
But that's never an ability that's granted to a player, because it's kind of unfair from the player perspective of, I'm going 5 times, and everyone else during combat is going once, and I'm taking so much of the spotlight just inherently.
One gripe I do have with that is the characters that you, like player characters that usually have multiple actions in a turn, multiple turns in a round, for example, they usually have more complicated characters with more complicated mechanics that kind of facilitate the more turns. So unless you're really like streamlined in terms of this is what I'm doing for all of these, I feel like it really clogs up any encounter.
So I have one example of it that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually an Exalted, funnily enough. So
we're already disagreeing. Okay.
That's fine. So we were disagreeing beforehand, but in general, I agree with you. I think that player characters having multiple turns in a round is unbalanced for multiple reasons. But there's a part of my head that's like, wow, that really sparks joy in a specific way because it makes me this is a mechanical way to explain that my character is really competent in this area. But in general, I agree with you that it's unbalanced and such. The one example I have that I like that the way they did it and the way that it plays out is in Exalted. And it is a capstone ability of specific martial art that you can only get at the highest level of play unless you made that martial art your special supernal ability.
Mm-hmm.
And it is... The martial art's like single point into the something. I can't remember the exact name of it. It's basically the weeb martial art where you have the katana and you do the thing and then you close it and then everybody's like,
the weeb
blood.
Martial art in the weeb game.
Yeah. No, it is the most weeby, but like it does that. And the way they did multiple turns in a round was the fact that the explanation was your sword, you are so fast with your sword that your sword has its own initiative. And so it's not that you have a second turn, it's that your sword has its own turn.
Hmm.
And your sword can't move to where you weren't already there. You don't get more movement per turn. You don't suddenly become faster on your feet. It's just you can essentially make two attacks a turn, and that's it.
I agree with... I do like the explanation of, oh yeah, my character's just really talented in this situation. I can operate at a higher efficiency. But the way that translates mechanically into game, I haven't really found a way that I enjoy as a player as much.
I, flavor-wise, really like the concept of, the flavor of a lot of things that do... that give you multiple actions, and it's for me usually not even like I'm very good at this that gives me multiple actions. I like other flavor things, like for example you doze on a highly addictive drug but it like enhances your perception and reaction speed.
It gives
and
you
makes,
bullet time
and makes you move faster, you know, that kind of stuff is what I like. And so flavor-wise, I really like the concept of characters being able to go multiple times. However, like, especially when it's not, like, skill-based, when it's, like, these, like, external factors that could potentially have consequences or what have you, no game's mechanics has been really super clean with this. The cleanest and nicest, and I kind of like it, is first edition Eclipse Phase, so I was sad to see it go. That said, when we were playing, it seemed fine. Like, not having the speed really didn't change anything gameplay-wise. Like, we didn't lose anything. And this is, like, kind of what we're talking about in general, where it's like they've made these bunch of changes that are stripping down from first edition to second edition, and it's like, do we feel like we've lost anything? And so while I'm very sad that this mechanic is gone... like, when we played it, I didn't feel like we lost anything. Haven't stripped that away. And, like, I understand the mechanical problems that some players having more turns and others not gives. So it's, like, it's one of those things where I'm reluctantly acceptant of the fact that they removed speed. Like, I miss it. I really liked it. I might incorporate it
in a homebrew
game, or maybe not even an Eclipse Phase game, but like if I were designing my own system, like, and I wanted to include a multiple turns for a character type of mechanic, I would probably use the speed system from first edition. But I also understand the pitfalls with the speed system. So I'm like, I understand why they removed it. It didn't really take away much from the gameplay. So you know what? Maybe that's for the better.
Yeah, it's just like full character turns are long, complicated things, and giving one character more of that than everyone else just isn't that fun. Things like interrupt actions or reactions, like the ability to like do small specific things outside of your turn, I think is often quite fun. Like Lancer has a lot of those where it's like, oh, this is an action you can take, you know, if your ally gets shot, you can take an action like immediately to shoot him. So it's like cause effect direct instead of the whole freedom that is a full character action.
You heard it here first. Chris doesn't like freedom.
All right.
I will die on that hill.
Right, you also heard it here first. Anis is addicted to speed.
I'm not coming off here because this is a very much general topics discussion we're kind of getting into.
Hey, you get two for one.
I do want to talk more about into because we were talking about phase. What started this whole tangent was the ego changes and so the other half of that would be the morph changes, which are pretty significant. When you choose a new morph, it no longer has any skill modifiers to it. The only thing you're changing when you're like re-sleeving, for example, which is choosing a new morph, is the pools, the new kind of Moxie rework system.
Doesn't it maybe I missed this, doesn't it still change your maximum aptitudes?
Don't quite remember. I don't think it does.
I don't think it does. Yeah, this is another thing where I wasn't looking closely at the gear and stuff, so I wasn't sure if it did. But okay, so it doesn't affect your pools, attributes.
It does. It almost exclusively affects your pools.
And pools is a new mechanic that they kind of reworked the old Moxie system into. Yeah. Moxie was kind of your
meta currency,
your luck point, whatever, to have some sort of agency or
outside influence.
Yeah, player effect on the actual narrative, narrative control for a player.
Yeah, so like D&D inspiration, the ability to reroll a d20 if it's bad, or Shadowrun with Edge, like a resource that you can spend that your character's not necessarily aware of that only really affects the dice.
Yeah, and to be fair, Moxie in, or the pools in second edition do a lot of, if not everything, the old Moxie system used to do, but there are four different categories that, based on your morph, and I think there's a couple of traits as well that affect how many of each pool you have. There are four pools.
It is Flex,
Insight, Flex, Vigor, and Moxie.
Yeah. Yes.
And Insight is more like mental, you can kind of categorize them as mental,
knowledge skills.
Yeah, mental knowledge skills.
It's like physical, charisma, and mental is how I would just...
Moxie is more social, based roles.
Social, that's a good word for it.
Vigor is more combat / physical.
Physical, yeah.
And then Flex is...
flexible.
Yeah, flexible. You can use it for
do what you want.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So we talked a bunch about Moxie when we talked about first edition.
Yeah.
Moxie was the only pool in first edition, and it was fun, like the couple of different uses you have.
Yeah.
So with this one, Flex is basically the old Moxie. It's harder to get, I feel, than the old Moxie, maybe.
You can't get as much of it.
Yeah, you can't get as much as the old Moxie, but you can do everything you could do with the old Moxie with Flex points.
Yeah.
Use them in any dice pool.
And any character can invest into more Flex points in character creation.
Yeah. The more specialized one, Vigor, Insight, and Moxie now, you can do what you can do with a Flex point, but only for their field. So, like, at Mach C, you can do what you can do with a flex point, but only on social tests.
Yes.
As well as each of them has new sub-uses that are specific to their areas.
Yeah.
And then even flex has one or two things that are new to the old Moxie system.
Yeah, that are new from the old Moxie system. So it's kind of like a... It's funny because it's like they stripped down a lot of other mechanics. This is the one mechanic that they've added more detail to.
I think this goes into a little bit what they were trying to do with this second edition sort of refinement rework is giving more control to the players in actual gameplay. I feel like because you have so many more pools and things to do with the different pool points.
Yeah, it's more interactable.
Yeah, it allows the player to have a lot more say on what's happening.
Yeah. I will say it is also a lot. When I was running the one shot, it is the one thing I had to reference back to the most. That I don't think you'd have to reference back to it at all in first edition. It's one of those things where it's like, maybe with enough gameplay, you just get used to what all of them do. But it is one thing that I'm like, this feels like it'd be overwhelming for a new player. This is like a lot of different point, like different types of pools that each do different things.
The way you get the points back is very specific.
Yeah.
See, what I would like, and because for my morph that I chose for the one shot, I got like 3 vigor pools. I got one in each of the other ones, and then I also like spend some into flex. And so what I might like a little bit more is if you kind of were forced into, you know, one of the 3 more specialized one or one or two of them instead of having access to all 3, because it does get a little bit overwhelming if you have all 3 and then also the flex. Because I think it allows for more, I don't know, like classical classes where you're specialized into this. This is kind of what your character does, which I know isn't really the whole point of Eclipse Phase. I don't know. Eclipse Phase feels very much like you can make whatever, right? But I do like that aspect of it. I think it's... I like more narrative control as a player, so I think this affords that to me, which I like.
The main problem is I don't think it gives you any more narrative control than old Moxie did.
Really? It gives you more options.
I think it does, but we just didn't use the options.
No, I used them once or twice.
Yeah.
I think you can kind of just bump up Moxie and not divide it out. I think the division didn't really help solve the problems that it looked like they were trying to solve. And really ends up, I think, homogenizing a lot of the characters, because in terms of what you're getting from your morphs, I'm going to do a Santi argument now from earlier with the egos. The morphs feel like the place where your character should be getting like cool, interesting mechanical benefits from your character choices, because that's a thing that you can swap out and you can change and are going to get replaced.
Like we talked about in the first edition, it is kind of like gear.
Yeah. So, like, the octopus in first edition, being able to, like, you have 8 arms and can crawl up walls at will and do all of these interesting things, to me, is more fun than the options of, like, oh, I have more vigor pool.
Yeah.
And any morph that has vigor has the exact same options as you. So there's not really a point to the morph. There's not any interesting thing that this morph is doing that another morph isn't.
I do agree with that. I mean, I'm not, like, saying yes to the pools and
you
no
could
to
have
that.
Both.
I would like for the both. I do like the introduction of it, but I do think it is losing something from not having the specializations from the actual morphs.
Yeah, I think it's... I'm looking at it, and there are some narrative things they added. They could have just added to Moxie and kept it as one pool. Like, you can, for example, introduce a new NPC or item or change something about the environment.
We did that in the one shot where I was in the laboratory and I'm like, okay, I don't have the password. Can I use a point that these are fucking nerds and there's like a sticky note with the password on there?
I changed, and again, this is like, you know, this is one of those things where it's like you do the narrative, the collaborative storytelling with the GM, where I was like, well, given the setting, it wouldn't be a physical sticky note, but yeah, they have an AR note right there with the password visible for anyone that has a mesh active, you know? That kind of stuff is, I think, really cool, but it could have just added those as options to regular Moxie instead of having all this different Moxie. I'm looking at the list now and it's like there, it's funny that like there's one of the things we're talking about is kind of brought up here. There is a use for vigor. You can spend a point to, during your turn, gain an extra action. A point of vigor. So it's kind of like a more limited version of like speed or having multiple actions. So it's like, yeah, I see it, you know, a new Furinomorph that is more combat specialized. Maybe, you know, that's useful, but it's like, maybe that's the thing you just add to the point an option for the point pool. Maybe like that's not a thing you need for the system at all.
You could also just like give morph special abilities that are powered by Moxie. So you could be like, hey, all combat morphs have, you know, whatever this specialized power is that lets you spend a Moxie point to gain an extra action in combat.
Yeah.
That seems...
Yeah, like an implant maybe that like you can have that like lets you spend a Moxie to gain an extra action.
Yeah, like it feels like there's better ways to accomplish what they did without stripping away the fun that you had from morphs in the previous edition.
That does get into another point, though, of the, like, how much do you want to simplify versus how much do you want to introduce more mechanics? Like, if you introduce a mechanic for each morph, then, well, that's more things now, right?
Yeah.
So it is a balancing act, but I do agree with you. I like that.
But my counterpoint to that is they were already adding more complexity. They added these four pools that weren't there before and added all these different abilities.
Yeah.
If instead they kept it as one pool and they just, like, there's a piece of gear that's an implant that's, like, you can spend a Moxie to gain this effect, that works.
Yeah, but, I mean, how many
options
are there versus...
Like it,
three pools.
Yeah, but I'm saying it doesn't have to be a built-in thing into morphs.
Sure.
If it's just like an implant you could choose to add to your morph or, you know, something like that, then it's an option that's there and the base rules of the game don't gain more complexity.
That's fair.
It's a more complex system, but it doesn't really add any depth to the character. Like, it doesn't interact with any other mechanics in interesting ways. And I don't think it sparks anything as a character creation or, like, from an optimizer perspective to be like, ooh, I want to improve my vigor pool so I can do X, Y, Z. It's like, cool, I have vigor. And that's it. Like, it's just this is a thing you
I'll tell you, you have vigor. You can choose to go first in a turn. You can choose to gain an extra action in a turn. Or you can ignore a wound. Otherwise, it's just a flex point that you can only use on physical tests.
They just didn't do enough to me to justify the change.
I think I like the idea of it in practicality, in the actual, like, playing of the game. Yeah, I think it did lose a bit without introducing enough, I don't know, interesting things.
All the interesting thing it introduced are new options with flex points, which is the narrative stuff, the adding to a scene, the getting a clue, all that stuff. And that's just, you could do that with the flex points, a.k.a. the old Moxie. So we could have kept it one pool, just added some narrative stuff, which I like. I like those kinds of mechanics that let you... narratively change the scene. I'm a big fan of the retcon mechanic from Blades in the Dark, for example. And this is that kind of mechanic. It's just other things around it feel a little bit messy.
It's like, funny because I think there are some, like, I think in the Moxie pool there's something similar to that where it's like you can use a Moxie point to negate something that, oh, my character wouldn't have done that.
Oh, yeah, negate a gaffe. Here, I'm looking at the list. So it's like if you make a social gaffe, you can use the new moxie, which is the social point pool, to just be like, I didn't make that social mistake.
Yeah. So it's similar, but
I feel like we just... They were so close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This feels like a third edition will be really nice and smooth.
I don't hate it. Like, I think... I like simplifying some things. I do think a bit of the charm is lost from being able to specialize. And it does look... It does... Yeah, I agree. It becomes a little bit more homogenous in terms of characters. So, I don't know. I think also... We would definitely have to play a lot more to get more of a feeling towards what we prefer. I mean, we all played, well, maybe not all, but most of us have played a lot more first edition than second edition. So we are coming in with that sort of bias of we know a lot about first edition and having experienced it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we tried first or second edition out, and yeah, we are noticing some differences that we might not enjoy as much.
Yeah, I think what I would love to see for Morph specifically is a little bit back hearkening to first edition, but just like for the Morphs, giving them almost like Spire-like abilities of like, you can do this thing. Like, you can always do X, or once per session, you can do X, or spend a Vigor or Moxie or whatever to do...
I really like that, as well. But I wouldn't like it to be too much. I would like it to be, like, maybe one or two things.
Yeah, one or two things for each morph, and then it's, like, a cool, fun thing to play around. And when your morph inevitably gets destroyed, you get the fun of seeing how your same character interacts with a different morph that has different abilities. And then you can, like, re-sleeve based on the situation or job you're going into. Like, there's just more to do there.
I will say there is the fact that it doesn't affect your attributes means your character is not really as affected by re-sleeving, which in a way is encouraging you to play around with different morphs with the same character. But again, like, if you were gaining no real benefit, like, there's... maybe only a narrative reason to receive, and like narratively, I mean, like, do you want to be in a foreign body or just in a body you're comfortable with?
My character should be radically different if I'm in an octopus or a human, or if I'm a giant floating sphere with guns. Like,
yeah, mechanically, there's not much difference, and so I think morphs to hit in second edition.
Mm-hmm. I will say there's one like minor thing. We already said this, and this is just like a thing I liked. Networking being removed as a skill, and instead you use your rep for all your social like networking skill tests.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was very smooth, and I feel like it also encouraged players to use their rep more, because there's like something about like the separation of the two, like. And the fact that it felt like a more complex system, like, was daunting to players. That's something I observed in first edition, that even players who had rep and a networking skill that fit that rep didn't really try to use it or engage
it.
Use it. Yeah. And I feel like part of it is like, you know, you have this system that's different, because like not a lot of, aka not any other tabletop RPG I know has a rep type system, because they don't deal with this type of economy questions in their settings. So it's like it's a foreign concept to the player, and the fact that it's also felt like a complicated mechanic, I felt like players shied away from it a bit more.
Yeah.
The fact that it was simpler and easier to use and understand just, I feel like, made players more encouraged to use it.
I think one part that made the rep and networking more useful and more like immediately like accessible to players is the fact that in first edition you just had rep and networking, and it's like you can roll to get stuff and we'll see what you get, and this is it. In second edition, it's like I think it was like per story or something, you have access to like a minor, like a few minor requests and a major request, and I can't remember what the last kind of request is.
So yeah, it's requests go from, it's trivial, minor, major, and what's the name of the last one?
I can't remember the name of the last one.
Extreme.
Yeah, like,
it might be extreme.
It's something like that, and it's like you get... And it's, you get as many trivial requests as you want, 3 minor requests a week, 1 major request a week, 1 extreme request per story arc. So it's like players knew, oh, this is also like a resource that I can dip into and like try to use. And they knew like this refreshes.
And there's options to burn your rep to
increase the chance of getting it. Yeah.
You can also burn your rep to get more uses. Like it's like, oh, I already used my major, favor, but I want a second major favor. I can burn like permanently reduce your reputation with a group to get a second major favor.
Yeah. As a person who has literally never touched the rep system mm-hmm. in first edition, going into second edition, it felt so like smooth and clear. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I get to ask for certain kinds of favors that I can just ask the GM. I want this thing. What level of favor is that? And then I decide like, oh, and which group do I want it from based on like their attributes and that adds to the flavor. And I really enjoy what they did with mm-hmm. the rep system. I think it was a absolutely brilliant change.
In first edition, I would say I was a little more like wary and scared to use it because I just didn't know exactly how to leverage it the best way I could. In second edition, I agree. I was excited to use that. I was like, oh fuck yeah, I got a perfect use for this. Like mm-hmm. I know exactly what I'm going to ask for from this faction because I know they have a following on this planet.
And even from a role-playing perspective, it's like that bridging of optimization with role-playing where I'm like, well, I sure do want some bombs right now. I'm going to hit up my eco-terrorist friends and see if they got anything in the city right now.
I will say there's also a GM-like setting benefit. It's like when you're sending your players to different locations, you can tell them, oh, these factions have more for sway, these factions have less for sway, so the favors for the factions with more sway will get you more versus like the less sway. And I feel like it gives a bit more flavor to like different locations. It's like, oh, this is the place where these people are more in charge of this place.
Give the world a little more bite.
Plus different players and characters get to do more in different settings, and it helps take away that issue that you find a lot in other systems where your social character is the only one with a social life, and any character who's like, I haven't put any stats in being a social person, it's like, I will never interact with that in my life. I will never ask somebody for a favor. But with this, it's like, even at the minimum, your character has one faction that they're strongly aligned with that they can often get things from. So even though a social character will have more rep and like more, maybe more factions or maybe a few that they are strongly aligned with, they get benefit from it, but it's not like other characters can't use that part of the system.
Mm-hmm.
Any other any overall thoughts about the second edition?
I think we pretty much covered everything that I wanted to talk about. I think, in general, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the general consensus is it's been simplified in character creation and in a few areas that are nice for newer players to get into, and even just when you want to create more characters, it's a lot simpler. Some specializations may have taken a hit. If you want to, you know, really theory craft, you have less options to do so. I would say there is a bit more narrative control for the players. I think more narrative play has been focused in the second edition.
I feel like that's not just the second edition. I feel like that's a lot of like emerging tabletop RPGs in general are leaning more into narrative play over mechanic play.
I've noticed that as well. Yeah.
Or at least like introducing mechanics for more interesting narrative play.
So in general, personally, I like second edition. I am cautiously optimistic. I would like to play it more, get more of a feeling.
If you had to play a campaign with either first or second, which would you choose?
Like you were like, okay, we want to, you had a group, you're like, right, we want to play Eclipse Phase, we want that setting. Which would you play? Which would you want?
Right now, I would go with second edition.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. I really like the way they did networking and rep. If I could just take that and put in first edition, I would do first edition.
I feel like the real answer for this group is we would do a Shadowrun 5.5, like we've done, where it's like, we're going to take all the bits from the new one that we really like, and we're going to apply it to the old one.
Yeah. Because we're better than the game.
We know better.
I feel like I would do the opposite. I would take things from the old one and apply it to the new one, rather than things from the new one and apply it to the old one, personally. But again, if it's like no modifications, which of the two, I'd pick second edition. But realistically, I'd do second edition with the elements that I still wanted from first edition.
With the caveat of no fucking modifications, I think as a player, I'd want to play second edition. Yeah. As a GM, I'd want to run first edition.
Yeah, that's fair.
Chris?
I wouldn't play either.
I hate them both, actually.
I just think both of them miss the mark from what I'm looking for in a tabletop system. I do like second edition a lot better. I legitimately think if the issues that I had with morphs and the new pools were resolved, I would easily see myself playing in second edition. But just, like, they don't have enough, like, interconnectivity of systems for what I enjoy, but the rep system, like, I think playing a social character in second edition would be incredible amounts of fun.
I mean, it was for me, yeah.
But as a combat nerd, it doesn't give me the combat nerd vibes that I want.
I did mention when we were talking about first edition that I really like the mechanics of Eclipse Phase. Like, there's something about it that has really captured me, like the simplicity of the dice that you never change what you're rolling. It's very clear to me, like, this is to me, like, percentage wise what it is. And I had said that I might take some things out and use the mechanics to run a non-Eclipse Phase setting, like maybe a modern day setting. Second edition is even better for that than first edition was. Like, if I wanted to use Eclipse Phase-esque, like, you know, modified Eclipse Phase set, mechanics for non-Eclipse Phase setting, for, let's say, a modern-day campaign or something like that, I feel like second edition is much nicer for that than first edition.
It's got good bones.
And if you're doing a modern-day setting, you probably won't have to deal with the ego morph situation.
Yeah, exactly, which is why it's like, that is a concern in that aspect, but when it's like, if you were going to remove that anyway to run a non-Eclipse Phase setting, that this just fits, slots in much nicer.
Yeah, all right, like, well, so you take Spire and you take Eclipse Phase and you make a baby.
With Blades in the Dark as the uncle.
Jeez.
There's one last topic.
I make her own system.
That's what this is all leading to.
Yeah. I mean, that's what
we make our own system and review it, and it's just like, this is the greatest.
This is the best one.
Alternatively, this is just dog shit. We're bad.
Fuck, we don't know what we're talking about.
I was saying, isn't that what any, like, content about tabletop RPGs eventually boils down to? Is like making a book.
Yeah.
Either adding to a system or making your own system.
Yeah.
I mean, way to call us out.
That's our 20-year plan, guys.
Yikes. 10 years, we'll have the first draft.
So after World War III, in the apocalypse, we'll have a tabletop RPG for that.
In 5 years, we'll have a Patreon.
Yeah, exactly.
There's one last topic I wanted to touch on that is kind of related to the system, and it is the one-shots we ran. So we kind of talked about them, but I feel like the one-shots ended up very different and spawning from very similar idea, the first edition one shot and the second edition one shot. And part of that is, I feel like Chris had the unfortunate thing with first edition that I have come to hate, which is running a system before you've played it. Trying to run a system before you've played it, like, you don't have a measure for the pace of the system or the vibes or the setting. It's like, it's all kind of clunky and in your head because you're not used to it.
To be fair, that is a problem that's going to happen to anybody or any system.
No matter how much you read about it, unless you've experienced it, it's going to take some time to get used to.
Yes. So it's a thing that I have a sore spot with because I feel like it heavily impacted my experiences with Shadowrun. Because I've never played Shadowrun as a player. I've only ever been a GM. And, like, especially, like, the first couple of campaigns I ran of Shadowrun, I feel like were impacted. And up till today, I feel like I've only run one actual Shadowrun campaign. The rest have been some weird, messed up by other ideas thing, because I just wasn't, like, familiar with the system. So I feel like part of it is that. But then the other part is what to focus on. Chris's one shot was very heavily focused on the combat of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's nice and all, but I feel like Eclipse Phase in general doesn't thrive, is one of those systems that is not like a, does not thrive in the combat. Like,
I mean, it marketed itself as a horror RPG. It is closer to Call of Cthulhu than it is to D&D.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so it's funny, though, because when we sat down for the first edition one-shot, I had already had the framework for the second edition one-shot. And then you did the first edition one-shot, and it was the exact same framework I have. I ended up later making modifications to that, but your setup was exactly my setup. My setup was, there is a black research facility. I hadn't decided exactly where, and they're doing some research on psionics that affect and like the virus, I forget its exact name.
Exosurgent.
Yeah, the exosurgent virus that affects metal brains, cyber brains, and you're going in to eliminate that threat. Like, that was my framework, and that was exactly the same framework for your one.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, interestingly, like encounter design, yours ended up being much more leaning towards the combat. Mine, from the beginning, was leaning towards the investigation side of things and maybe using your rep to get access to things and that kind of side to things. And then maybe just fighting the thing at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, fighting each other is what ended up happening. But I mean, like, I feel like that's also like in our one shot was my way of like with the horror aspect of Eclipse Phase, and we said this in first edition where it's hard to do in a one shot because the horror aspect is supposed to be like this slow draining thing, yeah. Slow building draining thing that is like an existential horror, and that's why one of the mechanics is like mental stress and mental trauma, and that's meant to build and build and build until your character breaks down.
Yeah, we hadn't, with my one shot, we hadn't gotten to the second half that I planned, because we went over a little bit on like timing. I expected you to kill everything much faster, but the second half was intended as a you guys recover the thing, and it gets out and slowly starts like draining the oxygen from your ship and like infecting members of the crew and like handing out everyone a blank piece of paper and being like, okay, read this, and for all of you it's like, nothing, you're fine, don't react to this. And then everyone's like, what did you just tell you?
we saw everyone got a note.
So I tried to do a similar thing where I used one of the mechanics that's also there in first edition, is characters have motivation. And I basically was like, as they got near the end of the session, were infected by the virus, I was like, okay, pick a motivation. I gave you guys the choice of what motivation. Like, pick one of your motivations, swap it for this motivation.
Yeah.
As, like, this thing is consuming your mind. And most of the combat we had in our session was player versus player.
Yeah.
Because the enemy that I ended up picking was, again, because I looked at it and I was like, a very combat-oriented thing is not as interesting, and there isn't, like, a big combat threat that I can present. So I picked an enemy that it's, like, it's basically a sleeper agent, where it infects other things with its personality.
Personally, I think it's bullshit that the two combat characters in the one-shot got infected, and the social character had to be like, please don't shoot me or each other.
I was very happy with that end. Like, when it ended, like, it ended with, you know, you guys calling in a favor to nuke the city you were in. And, you know, like, it ended on a very fitting in my head Eclipse Phase and Firewall note, because if this was a longer campaign, like, you know, the city would be nuked, Firewall would be like, would consider it mission complete, but there would be like an effect on your rep because of all the things you do. I think one of you burned some rep for that nuke at the end.
I did, yeah.
Yeah. And then you guys are sleeved into new bodies and you have no memories of what happened, yeah, but there's the effect on your rep and a record of mission success.
That feels very Eclipse Phase, where it's like success with consequence, and then also like, well, you're back in it, your ego's there, but you have no...
Oh, what happened to that city?
Yeah.
Oh!
You succeeded on the mission, that's what happened.
Yeah, and it's like, it's this feeling of like, it's giving you this like mixed emotion of, it's like, you succeeded, but it like that emotional cost.
I nuked a city.
At that point in time, you have to also consider what success means.
Yeah.
Because initially we're like, oh, our mission is to stop the spread of the infection and identify it and make sure it doesn't threaten humanity. And what our mission ended up being like is confirming whether or not it was worth nuking a place. That was our mission. Yeah. It was, is it worth nuking? Yes? Okay, mission accomplished.
Yeah.
No? Okay, mission accomplished.
By the end of it, we did check all the initial boxes.
I feel like there was a funny part near the beginning for the one shot where I used the line to kind of give the things emotional weight, and you guys misunderstood the line, where I was like, remember, you guys are humanity's only option. And you're like, oh, I guess, you know, you'd pick a better option if one was there. And I was like, no, I mean, like, if you're the only option, if you guys don't succeed, it could be the end of humanity.
You're like our last defense right now.
Last and only defense.
Yeah.
You have to succeed.
Don't worry, boss. We've already known when we were the Z team.
That was very funny, of just being like, you're the only option. It's like, damn, dude, you don't have to...
hurt us emotionally like that. It's like, no, like, I mean, like...
You mean, like, we're the last line of defense against...
But you're the only line of defense. You're the first and last.
You really need contingencies for a system like this, guys.
There should be multiple
lines.
There
should be a backup. I understand if we're the last line of defense, that's kind of, you know...
Technically, the
endearing
foe.
But if you're the only... line of defense, just like
I intended to like give it a weight, but it was very funny how you guys took it.
To be fair,
we took it in character.
Yeah. we were riffing off in the beginning, the three of us, with our characters.
Yeah.
I would say actually, this is another thing that I feel like I had an advantage on compared to you, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Is that we only had three players for my one shot versus
True.
Four for yours, and I feel like that maybe made the difference.
Yeah.
Because timing wise, three felt like sweet spot for what we tried to do with these one shots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am also just at a natural disadvantage for Eclipse Phase because it felt like it had a combat system to
it.
But so my monkey brain is like, it has combat, I must test the combat to its fullest extent. But really that's not system is for. So
I feel like it's an interesting
thing. Direction.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing I see in a lot of systems where it's like they feel like, I don't know, maybe it's a legacy thing that it's always been done this way, and so it's like combat has to be super extensive. Even if that's not what they want out of the system, I feel like that's what is happening in Eclipse Phase. Versus you look at newer systems, say Blades in the Dark, where there's no difference between a combat scene and a non-combat scene in Blades in the Dark, and the mechanics are kind of more abstracted, so it doesn't matter.
I mean, it's definitely a legacy thing from, and this is just not to get into the weeds of the history of tabletop games in general, but
next
like,
not next episode, but in an upcoming
episode.
I promise, in the very next episode,
promise because we already have the next episode recorded, and it's not that.
But no, it is definitely a legacy thing because it basically comes down to what do you need rules to decide for
mm-hmm.
you, and you don't need rules to decide, hey, this argument's convincing because you just say it, whereas you need rules to decide, hey, my person stabs your person. Mm-hmm. Like it's the you know, little kid version of like, well, my Superman has immunity to kryptonite. Yeah, well, mine has immunity beating kryptonite. So we'll see like, what wins.
I have super kryptonite that beats immunity
to
kryptonite.
Yeah, it's like, okay, it's like, it's that, but, you know, the adult version of that, it's just like, we can't just keep arguing which one's better. We need some sort of resolution mechanic. And 9 times out of 10, we're not actually beating the fuck out of each other.
Yeah. But, like, by the time you're adding things like soak and health points and, like, stamina and speed, as an example, like, I think speed is way too crunchy to have in a game where the expectation is that, combat is like short and quick and like last possible option, unlike something like D&D where a good portion of the game is like the crunchy combat, or Lancer where the point
that's
is
the main focus.
You're gonna fight in big mechs and that's what you want.
I feel like this is, again, like this may be a topic for another time, but this feels like a legacy versus modern tabletop RPG thing, where more modern, there are a lot more examples of modern RPGs. We said already that we're leaning towards more narrative, like storytelling focus, and I feel like we're also leaning more towards, it's like, A, that the social aspects are just as much a mechanic as the fighting aspects. That way you don't have to make an argument. You just have to have an character that we can imagine makes a convincing argument. And then the importance of that combat becomes less. I feel like as the scene matures more, people are less arguing my Superman over your Superman, and people are more like, you know, what's the interesting story we could tell? And so having to worry about those things becomes less of an issue.
I think it's, player, group, and GM dependent as well.
That's true as well. But
you also say the scene matures more, and my immediate thought is, like, the old school RPG people. And I'm like, guys, those are... they're geriatric. Like, what do you mean mature more? Like, the scene's pretty mature.
Yeah, we're just seeing, like, a separation of the war game from the, like, role-playing game a little bit, where you can have role-playing games without the war game, and you're having some war games without the role-playing games, even though for a long time they were very deeply intertwined.
Yeah. Well, I think that about does it for us on this episode of the Tabletops Podcast. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for joining me. Well, my name's been Caleb. Joining me, as always, have been
Chris,
Enes,
Santiago,
and what I said about vegetable oil.
You know what would be even funnier? If you don't include the previous part and just like, and what I said about vegetable oil.
You can use vegetable oil as motor oil in a pinch.
Can you?
You can. I wouldn't recommend it, but if it's all you got, it'll run your car for a little bit.
Yikes.
Anyways, thanks very much.
Oh, I thought you were referring to sex.
Yeah, no, that's what I was referring to. You read between the lines.
Please.
It's supposed to be subtle, actually.
Please don't use motor oil like that.
Unless you're a synth morph.
Here we go. Hey.